Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Our topic this hour is coffee. From beans to baristas to buzz, there are 100 million coffee drinkers in the U.S. Almost 90% of them say they make coffee at home, and roughly 40% of those cups being specialty coffee are the high-quality stuff. The Bay Area, where there are an estimated 1,400 coffee shops, has been described as a coffee playground, a place characterized by its coffee maturation, innovation, infatuation, and possibly saturation. In a region where small roasters and venture capitalists both are making their mark, coffee is no longer just a caffeine delivery system. For some consumers, it's not so much about the morning jolt or cafe ambience, but the taste. For others, a cafe is all about customer service. And for still others, well, they're fine with Folgers. Tonight we'll be asking, can you make a great cup of coffee at home? What do customers really want when they go out for coffee? What's in season now? Joining me in studio to discuss these issues are the following members of the Bay Area Coffee Brain Trust. Thompson Owen is an owner and coffee buyer for Sweet Maria's Coffee in West Oakland, a popular home coffee roasting website. Sweet Maria's sister site, CoffeeShrub.com, sells green coffee to roasting shops. Welcome, Tom.
Thanks.
Trish Rothgeb is the Director of Educational Services at the Coffee Quality Institute, a nonprofit that works to help coffee producers around the world. She is also the co-founder, green coffee buyer, and roastmaster of Wrecking Ball Coffee Roasters, a specialty coffee roaster in San Francisco. Trish has served on the Specialty Coffee Association of America's Roasters Guild Executive Council, was a charter member of the World Barista Championship Board of Directors, and a founding member of the Barista Guild of America. Welcome, Trish.
Thanks.
Nick Cho is the other co-founder of Wrecking Ball Coffee Roasters and is a brewing, barista training, and retailing specialist. Nick founded Murky Coffee in 2002, often called Washington, D.C.'s premier coffee bar. He has served as a director on the Barista Guild of America's Executive Council, on the Specialty Coffee Association of America's Board of Directors, on the World Barista Championship Board of Directors, and as the chairman of the U.S. Barista Championship. Welcome, Nick.
Hi.
And Frida Hoffman is the owner and general manager of Local 123, a West Berkeley cafe that also operates a coffee trailer at Flowerland Nursery in Albany. Before opening Local 123 4 years ago, Frida studied conflict management and did social work in Berlin and on the East Coast, where she grew up. Welcome, Frida.
Thank you.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation by dialing 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. We're also asking listeners to email us your coffee questions now for a special lightning round at the end of the show with our guests. Email your questions into cityvisions917@gmail.com. That's cityvisions917@gmail.com. Or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Well, we have such a terrific panel with us this evening with a lot of knowledge and expertise. I want to give listeners a sense of what each of these folks is doing in the coffee world. Tom, let's start with you. Tell us about Sweet Maria's.
Yes, Sweet Maria's is basically an internet site, and we started it quite a long time ago when in 1997 when I couldn't find anywhere to buy green coffee, raw coffee, to roast my own coffee at home. So I figured, well, I'll just find a place to buy it and start the business myself. And I thought I'd either sell my initial stash and kind of get free coffee for myself, and maybe that would be it, or maybe it would continue. And
that was how many years ago, Tom?
97. So it's been like 15 years. And so it succeeded. And I think on the internet, I was able to find people who were either crazy enough to really actually want to read everything I would write about the coffees I was trying to sell, or they were just, you know, really dedicated and had extra free time. So
there you have it. Trish, tell us about your work with the Coffee Quality Institute.
I've been working with the Coffee Quality Institute for many years on a program called the Q Program, where coffee buyers and people from the consuming world, so to say, go to the producing countries and kind of let them in on the secret of specialty. We're training them to understand what the buyer wants in terms of a specialty coffee, and it's done through a training program for tasting coffee, or what we call cupping coffee. So for a lot of years, I was what we call a Q grader, and I would go and teach this program, and now I've taken the job as director of Q. So most of our work is done outside the U.S. in the producing market, and like I said, trying to get them used to what the buyer wants in specialty, for because for them, they need to know what to produce.
And what are some of the countries you've gone to as part of this?
This year, I spent some time in Uganda, actually twice in Uganda. I've been to Indonesia, Latin America, Colombia, Brazil, anywhere that they're growing coffee. Ethiopia, I'm going in a few weeks. I've also gone to Taiwan and China, and these areas are growing in terms of the consuming world. So they're more interested in learning this as well as kind of a language to speak to the producer.
Right. Nick, tell us about founding Wrecking Ball Coffee Roasters with Trish.
We started Wrecking Ball Coffee Roasters about 4 or 5 years ago. We actually started on the East Coast. And, you know, Trish and I had met in a coffee event actually 10 years ago next year, and have been, we're friends for many years and now are partners in both life and in business. But, you know, for all of us who have some experience in the coffee industry, the question is always, do you have something new to say, new to add? And considering, you know, in many ways, I think there are different sort of generations or waves or what have you in the industry. And so we kind of represent sort of a certain transitions, a trans sort of generational demographic, both in maybe in age as well as in terms of our approach to coffee. And so, yeah, about 3 or 4 years ago, we started the company, and it's been growing very slowly. I think Trish has been very busy doing her work with CQI. I've been doing some consulting and teaching, and we both travel and speak a lot. But that said, you know, it's really all about being able to serve people great coffee, you know, the way that Frida gets to every day. So we're pretty jealous, and so we just want to be like Frida.
Well, that is a perfect segue, Frida, over to you. Can you tell us about Local 123?
Sure. We opened about 4 years ago in very great neighborhood in West Berkeley, where there wasn't really a lot of coffee happening, not a lot of cafes. We were thanked profusely by many neighbors when we did open. And we've been serving specialty coffee since we opened. We started with Flying Goat up in Healdsburg and continued into kind of a multi-roaster model and are serving four-barrel coffee today. We also have food that we serve, focus on that. That's a large part of our sales. So we're doing coffee, but we also have many other things on the plate. I think we're more of a community cafe. People come to us certainly as a destination for coffee, but the majority of our customers live and work in the neighborhood.
And two of your customers even just got married there, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
That's happening this Saturday. We've had a few weddings now at the cafe.
Exciting. Okay, let's talk about this term third wave of coffee, which, Trish, you allegedly coined. What does this mean, and what were the first and second waves?
Well, excuse me, I was noticing something. I came into coffee what I would call my entrance was in the second wave, if we want to talk about waves. The first wave, the way I describe it, would be when everybody in decided that they wanted to start consuming coffee. So it would have been toward the beginning of the last century when everyone decided they were going to drink coffee in the morning before they went off to work, and it all became about consumption and about consistency and about getting as much coffee out there to the world as possible from every perspective. And the second wave, that happened around the late 60s, 70s, and that was what we kind of know now as maybe Starbucks or the first coffee shops on the corner that we know of today. And this was a trend that let us know where the coffee came from. We could buy coffee from Guatemala or from Ethiopia. And we also learned the terms cappuccino and cafe latte. And these things were asked of us to learn these things. So we were sort of educated in that way. And then the third wave is the idea that we could actually take that a little further and we could find out where in Guatemala that coffee came from and maybe learn something about the producer who produced it and what pains that producer took to make the coffee that good. And then bringing it through to roasting it with a special hand and skill at the coffee roaster, and then producing a very beautiful cup at the coffee bar in a way that we haven't seen before maybe 10 years ago.
And Tom, you've been a big part of this third wave. How much has home roasting grown since you started?
I don't know that it's grown. I think there was a period of time about 5 years ago where people felt like this could be a really big thing, maybe 8 years ago, and everyone was trying to invent a new home roaster that would go next to your home bread making machine and whatever else. And I've always felt that it's a niche. It's really not for everybody, because what you're doing when you're home roasting is you're taking on yet another variable. Trish talks about the third wave, you know, all these controls of the variables and the coffee shop trying to put together the best final presentation of the best cup of coffee, and they get to control that and hand it to somebody and say, taste this. This is what we think really good coffee is. Well, with our business, they're handling all of those variables. Not only do they need to grind it and brew it correctly or within certain parameters to get a decent cup, but they have to roast it correctly, and that's actually quite difficult. So I've always just focused on it as a niche. I don't know that it belongs to this sort of wave theory so much. I mean, people were roasting coffee in their homes for years and years. Sears coffee, Sears catalog had green coffee for sale, and you bought the family home coffee roaster, which fit in a trivet on your coal burning stove, and you cranked it. And that's how you made coffee before the big wave of packaged goods mm-hmm. in the 20s. So,
got it. And Frida, tell us about Local 123. You opened in the same neighborhood as the original Pete's, so you are serving third wave, where the second wave kind of started. What was the reaction to your neighborhood when you came in and your decision about what kind of coffee to sell?
Well, like I said, I think people were happy that we were there. And I think a lot of people were also very confused as to what we were serving and why it cost so much and why we didn't have a grande decaf with three pumps of hazelnut. So it takes a lot of educating customers and having the time and the space to do that. And some people don't want to hear it at all, and that's fine, too. Hopefully we can give them something that will make them happy and that will approximate the experience that they were seeking to have at a place like Pete's that they're now going to have at Local 123, or they may leave. And that's unfortunate if somebody does walk out the door. But I think we can usually find a way to meet the customer where they're at and convince them that, hey, we're doing something special here that you're not going to get at Pete's, and why don't you hang out and have a taste?
And how much explaining do you have to do, and how do you have the time for that explaining if people are trying to move in and out quickly?
I have some excellent baristas. Mm-hmm. And I think when the line isn't, you know, 10 people deep, you have some time for that conversation. I think now that we've been open a few years, a lot of people know what to expect when they walk in the door, and that makes a huge difference. When we first opened, there was a lot of people walking out, unfortunately. And when we first opened, we also didn't have kind of a batch brewed coffee. You couldn't come in and just get, you know, your whatever large cup to go. You'd have to wait for us to make each cup for you individually. So I'm sure we lost a ton of business doing that. But it also allowed people to understand that we were doing something really different. And hopefully some of those people have stayed on, and the word has certainly spread. There's a cafe that just opened about five blocks down that's doing something very similar, Bardavel, serving great coffee in a space where people can also have food. And hopefully they've had to bear fewer questions about what the heck is going on with these prices and sizing and all that.
Now, Nick, you have also started a successful coffee shop back in Washington, D.C., of all places, my hometown, actually.
Oh, great.
What was that like, and what is the difference between the East Coast versus West Coast in terms of this third wave of coffee?
That's a great question. I mean, I think that there have been certain regional trends that come up, but you know, it's really hard for me to talk about them as a real trend when you were talking about maybe five or six well-known coffee shops that are sort of proliferating a certain profile or a certain way of doing things. You know, we see a pretty light roast, a very, very light roast trend right now in the Bay Area, for instance, maybe lighter than on most spots of the East Coast. I think that, you know, you see that. We saw that really start to come up in certain parts of Boston, but I can't call it a trend because it was one or two roasters that were doing it there at the time. But I think that I wanted to touch on something that Frida said. You know, she's talking about the way that, you know, the customers come in and encounter something that's very different and the way that you have to engage the customers differently. I think there's been a lot of confusion out there among people, especially in the Bay Area, about what exactly is this deal with people coming in, these young people coming in and telling me now about how I'm supposed to drink my coffee differently or how I'm drinking it wrong or something like that. And, you know, the fact is, and I think all four of us here are would be in some degree agreement, I'd be interested to hear, you know, their thoughts on it. My take on it has always been that, you know, if we only had one word for cooked beef, which just beef, and we didn't have steak and hamburger and you know, all these other terminologies, there'd be a lot of confusions when someone asks for ketchup and someone says, well, that's not really appropriate to put ketchup on your beef. You know, no one would confuse a hamburger with a steak. But when we're talking about coffee, we're talking, well, that's the only word we have. We have latte, cappuccino, but ultimately it's all about coffee. And so very often, you know, when there's a lot of confusion, yeah, I think that it really boils down to that, that what we're talking about these days, we're talking about third wave, it's a different approach to the coffee, but it's actually, it's because the coffee itself that we're presenting actually deserves a little bit different approach. It somewhat demands it in a way. That's how you derive the most pleasure out of it. Just like you can buy a $1,000 bottle of wine and just chug it or throw it into a sangria if you want. There's nothing wrong with that. If you paid for it.
Are you talking from experience here, Nick?
Absolutely. But the fact is that really going to be the best, you know, bang for your buck? If this is something that really has nuance and character that you can really, you know, get into in a connoisseurship kind of way, in an appreciation kind of way, like we talk about music appreciation or wine appreciation or art appreciation, where there's a little bit more of a dialogue with the thing rather than just partaking in it and enjoying it, that there's something to learn from it and that learning actually deepens the experience. That's what we're talking about more and more when we're talking about third wave coffee.
And when you're also talking about third wave coffee, you mentioned it's a lighter roast, right? So the second wave was kind of a heavier roast. And so it's different for people when they try the third wave. Can someone explain what the difference is in the methods? Go ahead, Trish.
Yeah, I think that what people were trying to do when they were drinking coffee in the 60s and 70s and they were trying to discover coffee, they wanted it to be not to taste like their grandpa's coffee or their grandma's coffee or their father's coffee. They wanted something that was a little bit more flavorful. And there was a trend, you know, in the middle of the last century to make everything really consistent and not and pretty light and pretty weak, actually, pretty insipid. And so the way they reacted to that was just to roast it a little bit more. And some have theorized that the actual dark roast never really was supposed to be that dark, that the granddaddy of that was Alfred Peet, who brought this kind of idea of darker roasted coffee to the Bay Area from Holland, and that it was more of a medium dark, and that over time people got used to taking it darker. And when I learned how to roast a little bit more than 20 years ago here in the Bay Area, I was taught to roast very dark like that. And so what happened was when people started to care more about the coffee itself, they wanted to bring out the best flavors in that coffee. They didn't want to obliterate that with the roast degree. So that's why we roast it a little bit more. I like to roast it a little more medium light. And that's why I think the pendulum swinging way, way light, because people are taking so much time and effort to find the green coffee. They don't want to obliterate those flavors.
Yeah, so you could see the roast flavor is being kind of overlaid on top of the, at that point, at a darker level, overlaid on top of the sort of intrinsic qualities of the green coffee, which from each origin and each subregion tastes different, maybe from each farm. So I think that's what, you know, to be clear, that's what Trish is talking about. And I think a lot of the dark roast tradition was like sort of wearing sunglasses in a dark room. You couldn't distinguish. That came between you and the coffee. But whether this new light roast trend kind of reverses that or doesn't just sort of also have its own opaqueness to it is sort of debatable.
Yeah, I think that with coffee, one of the things that's so great about coffee is that it is a beverage that comes with a lot of tradition, both personal tradition, family tradition, sort of cultural traditions. And the fact is that when you're looking at it in that way, kind of the way that different generations, you know, maybe music tends to rebel against the previous generation in certain ways, that the pendulum swings a little bit too far sometimes. And so when the dark roast thing really proliferated, and as Tom mentioned, you know, a lot of the intrinsic value and quality of that coffee maybe is a little bit masked, the way that, again, if you grilled a steak well done, you know, you might not do that with the USDA prompt.
Nick loves analogies so much.
Well, Nick's hungry.
My beef steak analogies tend to be the most common for coffee. But when you're, you know, when you're looking at coffees in that way and you really want to highlight that, there is a trend, I think, to push it further and further to sort of emphasize that point. And in a way, I think some of the pushback that comes from certain customers actually serves to make that pushback even more so and pushing it lighter and lighter to sort of make that point that actually this is what coffee can be like too.
Well, I would venture to say that was what Frida was dealing with when people wanted a certain flavor from that.
Right.
That place in that town, mm-hmm, where Pete's came from.
And people just have their habits, too. Yeah. People have been getting that same drink with three hazelnut pumps for however many years, and they come and want to check out our place, and, well, we don't have that, but we have something that might approximate that for you. Hopefully.
Well, this is great. We're going to circle back to that very point in a moment. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing all things coffee with our guests, Tom Owen, co-owner and coffee buyer at Sweet Maria's Coffee, coffee power couple Trish Rothgeb and Nick Cho, co-founders of Wrecking Ball Coffee Roasters in San Francisco, and Frida Hoffman, owner of the local 123 Cafe in Berkeley. We invite you to call us with your coffee comments or questions for our guests. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Nick, I want to ask you, picking up on that point, because you have done a lot of training of baristas, what is the barista's job in that situation when someone comes in asking for the type of drink they're used to and you don't have it? As you mentioned earlier, you don't want to be like, why are you drinking that stuff? You know, you're doing it all wrong. So you want to educate them. At the same time, there might be three people in line behind them trying to get to work. This is a very hard job. What do you tell people to do in that situation?
It's a difficult sort of thing, and it's a great question. I mean, the fact is that part of the point that coffee occupies right now, the space that it occupies, is a little bit awkward, which is that in many ways it's kind of like wine. It's kind of like, you know, what chefs do, but then it's very different. You know, it's kind of like beer, but then, you know, or wine, but there's more to preparation than just opening the bottle or things like that. But I think the biggest difference between maybe being a chef or being in wine and being in coffee is that coffee doesn't have, and some of your listeners might be surprised to hear this, but coffee doesn't really have institutionalized education in the way that maybe culinary school does, or you could get a degree in wine does. And so when you don't have that and you have an industry that doesn't have those kind of foundations, then what happens is that, you know, it actually attracts a lot of people who don't want to go to school, want to excel at something, be at the top of their game in a field that doesn't necessarily vet people out or get, you know, in that sort of sense. And so there's a lot of coffee shops opening up with a lot of young people who are really passionate, and the passion really drives it, and their interest, they get really into it, and it's sort of a rabbit hole, a deep rabbit hole of all this information and all this stuff that really is inspiring. Then to turn around and talk to the customer who wants to talk about something that's very different than what the barista wants to talk about, then you have a problem. For me, I mean, you know, I have some well-publicized stories about how, you know, maybe there were some stress points with customers and the way that they...
Tell us one. Share one with us.
Oh, boy.
Tell the iced coffee story.
To make a long story, I'll make a long story relatively short. There was an incident that happened, I think it was 2008, where I actually wasn't even there, but a customer came in, asked for espresso over ice, and at my shop in Washington, D.C., it was actually something that we did not offer for a number of different reasons. The main one being the baristas always got really bummed out because then the customers, 9 times out of 10, would take it to the condiment bar and fill it up with milk, you know, in a way basically sort of getting a free iced latte when they only paid for an iced espresso. And so this guy who was actually some kind of blogger and aspiring humorist or something like that took that opportunity to kind of mix it up with my staff and posted the story online. And it showed up on, I think, boingboing.net or something like that. And then I saw it. I happened to be actually in Seattle with Trish at the time. When I saw it, it really upset me because I felt like it was really sort of using my staff and my baristas as fodder for this weird story that was very self-serving and selfish. So I posted a public letter back to him, and it became this
little... I'm sure that calmed it down right there.
Well, we got calls from Reuters, from Washington Post, from the New York Times, from all over. You know, it was a mini sort of story at the time that it was this war between the customer and the shop. But what it was very interesting was that in the comments, and you know, about 5-6 years ago, it was really heyday of all the comments on different
right.
Internet sites. What was really interesting was how strongly people came down on one side or the other. In other words, is the customer always right, and therefore if I can have what I want, then I should be able to get it? Or should an establishment that's quality focused be able to offer what they want to offer, and we should be, you know, happy or, you know, whatever, to partake in that? And so it was an interesting debate, but the point is that, to sort of circle back to your question, is that no matter what we're doing in coffee, ultimately our end consumer, you know, we talk about them as consumers a lot in the industry, but what we're really talking about are coffee lovers. People really love coffee. When people talk about coffee, you know, and they tweet about it, they talk about how much they love it, how it makes them feel superhuman, it gets them going, it's a vital part of their day, how they'll die without it, things like that. And so I think that if baristas really keep that in mind, the special place that coffee occupies in people's lives, that I think that the people's approaches might be a little bit different.
Frida, would you serve an espresso over ice at local 123?
We generally do not do that, but if the customer is adamant about it, we will do that. We try to get them to taste the cold brew coffee that we do as an alternative to that, and it's a free taste. Usually people are into it, and they will go for whatever we suggest and we're excited about, and we're passionately telling them that they should just try. And some people are... they want their espresso over ice, and that's fine. We'll give them a very small cup so they don't fill it.
And have you had any kind of blow-ups of the type Nick just described?
Not that have been...
I hope not.
Yeah, not much press. But we've had some pretty scathing Yelp reviews.
Tom, let me get your take on this.
Well, I mean, we ideally, based on my personality, which is reclusive, we don't have this interaction with people. I mean, we get to just focus on coffee, on what's, you know, in the coffee bean and in the cup, and people can just stop reading online when they're had enough. So,
do you worry about whether people are going to follow your instructions or what they're going to do once they get your coffee? Are they going to ruin it, or do you just say, you know what, that's out of my hands at that point?
Well, it's tough. I mean, my job is I'm, you know, basically a personal shopper, and I travel all over and buy coffee on their behalf to give them the best raw material. And it does matter. I mean, if you do a really bad roasting technique on a mediocre coffee, you can never make coffee better in roasting. So if I give them good raw material, they're going to end up with a lot better coffee, even if it's poorly roasted. But yeah, it's a lot of education, and, you know, that's why it's just not really for everyone. It's a niche.
But I will add that, you know, Tom's website, sweetmarias.com, is renowned throughout the whole coffee industry as being one of the most comprehensive, if not the most comprehensive, resource for all things coffee on the entire internet.
He's one of the best educators that we have in the industry. And in fact, he's won awards for his website based on the writing, as if... Yeah, other people have won the same awards from the SCIA for books they've written, but he won it for writing so much information on his website, which not only amateurs or home brewers and home roasters use every day, but also professionals go to his website to read about these coffees.
I went for volume. I was word count.
All right. Tom's blushing over here, so we'll let him off the hook by going to our phones. We have Richard from Oakland. Richard, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. Thank you so much. My name is Richard Sandlin, and I know all four of your amazing panelists.
Oh, no. It's Richard.
Hi, Richard.
How are all y'all doing?
Good.
So I was asked to come on and speak a little bit about baristas and asked to kind of offer some kind of insight as to what the potential career opportunities as a barista could possibly be. But I'd like to pose it to the four of you. All of you at some point or another weren't owners of your own cafes, weren't owners of your own home roasting website, weren't owners of your own retail roastery. And I'd love to hear from the four of you, for people who want to get more involved in specialty coffee and really want to expand their horizon, build a career in this new industry that's attracting youngsters, what advice would you give them?
I think one of the most important things to do, I've been in this business for more than 20 years, and I started as a barista. And when I started, I didn't know all the things I had to learn. And so the greatest achievement I could ever have would be to become a roaster. Back then, I wanted to learn how to roast coffee, and then I did. And then I thought I had reached the pinnacle. And so then I spent years and years roasting, production roasting behind a roaster, and I learned so much about coffee. I think whatever a young person does, they have to stick in the job for a while to learn it. I think it might have been Malcolm Gladwell who brought up the idea that you should be 10,000 hours or 10 years in something to learn it really well. I think that some of the trouble we have is that people want to move up, or they want to get somewhere else, or they want to travel. They want to get all of these things right away.
And how about the venture capitalists coming in, too, into this business? I mean,
yeah, I think that for me, from my point of view, people have to stay in a job a while to really learn it. You can go to a course and learn how to roast coffee in a week and learn how to work the controls of the roaster. But to learn the coffee and all the different coffees to learn, you have to be there and be in the job for a while, whatever you choose to do.
And I think it is really hard to retain great baristas who have that inspiration, that aspiration like you had. You want to go to the pinnacle. You want to be roasting. And as a non-roaster retailer, it's really hard to keep great baristas.
Mm. Do you have a lot of turnover?
We do. I think we have less turnover than a lot of other cafes because we really care about what we're serving. And we have a great community in our neighborhood. But that is a definite problem for us. It's a challenge, I would say.
I think that for a lot of people who are getting into the industry, we were talking 20, 30 years ago, you know, with coffee is one of those crafts that really, to get ahead, it's really about apprenticeship, you know, to learn and to move ahead. And that takes, as Trish said, many, many years. But the fact is that with the internet, you know, people who are getting into coffee hop online and they see all these other people doing all these cool things and different things, and the grass is greener sort of principle kicks in. And there's, so I mean, especially in the Bay Area, actually, we've seen a lot of turnover, a lot of people who are on their fourth or fifth company in 3 or 4 years. Mm-hmm. And in many ways it's unfortunate, but it's also indicative of sort of where the industry is right now.
Tom, what's your answer to the caller's question, to Richard's question?
Well, I mean, I served coffee. That's, you know, before we called it barista, and what I served, I'd be ashamed of now. But it, at that time, that's the best, you know, we could do and with what we knew. I actually think that the way you get somewhere in coffee is you have to start your own thing. So you need parents and relatives and friends and credit cards. And there's a real problem in coffee at the top tier with the jobs. People can become very skilled and have a lot of trouble finding jobs in well-paying jobs with really good benefits and security. And, you know, the small companies have a lot of trouble offering those. And there's just so much space at the top. So it's a little disappointing. People can aspire for that, and if they don't start their own thing, it's hard to move up within the business of the small roasting shops and get somewhere.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing all things coffee with guest Tom Owen, the co-owner and coffee buyer at Sweet Maria's Coffee, Trish Rothgeb and Nick Cho, co-founders of Wrecking Ball Coffee Roasters in San Francisco, and Frida Hoffman, owner of Local 123 Cafe in Berkeley. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com or post a comment on klw.org or on our Facebook page. Richard, thank you so much for your call. We're now going to go to Benjamin from San Leandro. Benjamin, welcome to City Visions.
Thanks for taking my call, and kudos for having this discussion late at night. I was kind of surprised to hear it. But I wanted to just say, you know, I've sold coffee and I've sold wine and beer and other beverages over the years, and I was thinking about what you guys said about the darker roasting, and I feel like it's an American phenomenon of something that you like in a beverage, then a whole lot of it will be a lot better. And I think of it with the oaked California Chardonnay phenomenon that everyone latched onto and then has kind of weaned themselves off of. And I hope the same thing happening with beer, with the really, really hoppy beers, that will all end pretty soon. But I think it's more of like an American thing with our palates and our maybe aggressiveness towards what we want that is the culprit in all this.
Tom, I see you nodding your head there.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point. And you know what? I find it a lot in the scoring system we use for coffee. There's a lot of coffees that are sort of outrageous, and they have usually high acidity. It's not the kind of acidity that burns your stomach, but it's actually, you know, flavorful acidity, like sparkle, like brightness. And we rate that very highly. That increases the scores in the coffee, and there's, you know, fruited notes. There's this certain varietals that produce it, or you know, particular countries. But there's other coffees that I would say produce something you might call a very restrained cup. They're kind of wallflowers, but they're really good drinking coffees. It's really that classic flavor. It's clean. It has this kind of sweetness. It's a little hard to describe. You can't pile on 50 descriptors on it. But, you know, it's a real go-to coffee, and those score 85 points, and they get really punished. So there's something, you know, that I'm uncomfortable on a daily basis with about how we treat coffee in that regard. One's really not better than the other. Do you guys have any comment about that?
I personally think it's less of an American thing. It's actually a little bit more of a American men, a male thing.
Well, I think that what happens is that we... Like Tom said, when we buy coffee, well, Nick's talking about one-upmanship, you know, trying to make your coffee go to 11 or something, you know. But the idea of, the idea that Tom was bringing up about acidity, it's one of those things that I think is a disconnect between the average coffee guest or drinker and the professionals, because we're trained to find that acidity because that tells us there's a potential for sweetness. And then what we have to do at the roaster is then manifest that or coax that sweetness out of the coffee. And we forget that the average person doesn't like that much acidity punch that we have trained ourselves to enjoy or look for. So that's a disconnect that I think that Tom is talking about. When he's talking about good drinking coffees, I think that's what people want, a coffee that tastes like a good cup of coffee. And some of us make fun of the sort of overused terms in our industry, the marketing terms of bold and rich that are used to describe coffees. Because for us in the professional scene, it doesn't mean anything. But to an average person, it means a lot. They want something really kind of sweet and satisfying. And sometimes we lose track of that person's desire because we're caught in our own world of acidity and all of this crazy nuance.
How do you, you're someone, Frida, who has to translate that down in your cafe. How do you do that?
Well, we certainly get a lot of feedback about coffees that people think are too acidic, which they call bitter often. It's not pleasing to them for whatever reason. It's not what they're used to. So if we encounter that, we will try to... I'm still in the air. We will try to lead them to maybe a darker version of what they know, or a deeper, more robust, richer version, which is probably the espresso blend that we're serving, rather than some single origin coffee that scores very highly and is very bright, but unfortunately not pleasing to that person. So we try to use descriptors that aren't overblown and aren't too flowery, but try to make the descriptions of the coffee accessible for folks when they're trying to choose what they would like.
Let's talk about the supply chain now, because between the four of you, we can go from seed to cup and everything in between. Tom, can we start with you? How does this all get started?
Oh, that's really complicated, because every producing origin is completely different. And something that's true in Central America, where perhaps I work with a specific farmer, or we work with small farmers, we put their lots together. We pretty much know them. They know me, visit. But let's say someone will ask me, oh, what about farmers in Ethiopia? And it's like, well, they're co-ops, and there's that lot of coffee that was 150 bags, had 3,000 farmers contribute to it. So you work through cooperatives there, and there's some of the same aspects. So and that sort of analogy of how you work is so different from each origin. Mm-hmm. We'd have to break it down a little bit. And
why don't you do that just for one area where you particularly are fond of?
Well, I guess I'm proud of, we're working in northern Guatemala near the Mexican border in Huehuetenango, and there's large old farms down in the flatlands that have always sort of bought coffee from all their, mostly their employees that have really small holder farms up in the, on the steep sides of the hills, but that coffee's actually grown at much higher altitudes. So they were sort of benefiting from the fact that they would just buy all the cherries, the coffee fruit, and process it and add it to their own and get more punch, more acidity, whatever, in the cup. And we went in because they were getting paid very low prices and they had very few options. They could sell to multinationals that pre-finance their harvest, and that works well for them. It's ready cash, but the prices per quintal, per kg of cherry or parchment is very low. So, and we knew they had great quality. So we found one farmer in the area that had done really well in this competition called Cup of Excellence. They'd nearly won it in Guatemala. And we used him as kind of our base station and model. And he reached out to the community where everybody knew him, because they didn't really trust us when we came along. Then we have a mill in Antigua in an old coffee region, and he's looked at as a foreigner there. I mean, these are people that speak, you know, a mix of Spanish and Quiche and Mayan language, and it's so regional that little towns can't talk to each other that well. So we just sort of got a program going where we picked up farmers and families that we thought, groups of farmers that we thought were good. We started evaluating all their coffees differently, and maybe this guy's one bag and two bags and three bags. And over the season, we cupped, tasted about 500 to 600 samples, where we ended up buying three containers total. But for a normal coffee importer, they would have probably gotten 3, 4, 5 samples to buy 3 containers of coffee. They would have just chosen. We're doing this work of cupping, 600 samples. And the result was a lot of different lots. Some were not as good as we'd hoped, and we had to find homes for them based on that. But the farmers were all really excited. I visit after the season. They were excited about the price. We told them we're going to keep our price level next year, and we have a lot more farmers that want to sign on, I'm honestly scared there's too many, and I'm wondering if we can buy all their coffee, but we're going to try. So that's kind of a very ideal situation where we were able to drill down to a level that we didn't have access to before using a system. People call this direct trade. The really ironic thing is it's actually very indirect. It's a real system of cooperation between, we needed that guy in Antigua with the mill who knew how to keep all the coffee separate, who was very professional. We needed the local farmer that had grown quality coffee on his farm and wanted to both expand his business and also share that opportunity with his neighbors. So it's real relationships that you have to build.
That's amazing. Trish, let's now turn to the coffee gets to you for roasting. Tell us about that process.
Well, we have to, you know, Tom, I buy coffee from Tom and I buy coffee from a lot of different friends and colleagues that I've known over the years. And what happens is then I feel like I need a certain kind of coffee, and Tom might have told me about this Guatemalan project that he has going. So I'll get a sample of that and maybe some other samples that might fill the bill. And I roast them in a small miniature size roaster. And then I taste them in that process we call, it's a protocol we call cupping, which allows us to taste coffees next to each other so we can compare them. Maybe if we want to, we'll score them on that scale to 100 and decide based on the flavor profile which ones we want. And typically we roast that little sample up really light. We've talked about light roasting before. But then when we take it to the roaster, I'll buy as much as I'll need for maybe 2 or 3 months. I'm a small roaster, so I can kind of get away with buying small amounts like that. Other roasters will buy hopefully not more than like 4 or 5 months ahead what they'll need, because the coffee will fade a little bit. So you need to roast your coffee and taste it. From my perspective, a roaster needs to taste it just like a chef would taste every sauce that he makes. You need to taste every roast to make sure you've hit the point that you want to hit. And what you're trying to do, or what I'm trying to do, is finesse all of those elements so that, to maximize the ones that I enjoy and that I want to show the customer. So Tom might have a number of customers for that Guatemalan coffee. What I try to do is I try to roast it better than other people. And then because a lot of us are getting the same kind of coffees from the same regions, and how do you differentiate yourself in that way? And it really is a skill that you learn over time, and you decide your point of view with roasting, and then you really try to push that.
And Frida, how do you decide who to buy from and what to buy?
That is a very good question. And I think that's a difficult and telling question for a lot of smaller cafes who are interested in serving specialty coffee. We've kind of made the rounds, as I discussed before. But I think what is essential is to find a roaster who's really a partner, who you can trust, who you really know how they value and buy coffee. And this direct trade idea, this relationship coffee, is important to my business. It's important to me and to our customers. And we really try to let people know that that's what we're doing, and that's why this coffee is different, and that's why this roaster is different. So there are all these many, many steps that happen before the coffee gets to us, where we hopefully brew it properly after all this work has been done, so that the customer can appreciate it however they want. If they want to put cream and sugar in there, that's fine. Ideally, they can have it just straight and really appreciate all these elements and nuances in it.
Great. Okay, now it's what you've all been waiting for, our lightning round. So our terrific producer, Lisa Denmark, has been culling questions throughout the week and throughout the show from people emailing them in. Quick questions people have been asking about coffee, and who better to ask these questions to than the four of you. So let's get started here. The first one: why can't I have non-fat milk in my coffee?
You can at my place.
Okay.
There you go.
I'm lactose intolerant. Soy or almond in my coffee?
I'm also lactose intolerant. And,
me too.
And I get that kind of regular dairy milk if I want milk that doesn't have lactose in it, because I don't like the almond and I don't like the soy.
I would say, you know, I understand that sometimes the coffees get a little bit expensive, and so you want to enjoy it the way you want to enjoy it. But you might want to try it without any of that stuff at least once, and make sure you taste it all the way down to cool. And you might reveal something that you didn't know that you liked.
All right.
Or not.
I'm tired of the leaf design on my latte.
there are people who will do panda faces. There's a variation of the leaf that we like to call the flying monkey butt that is actually a poorly drawn heart. But you know, it's
why is someone tired of the leaf on there? That's so funny.
I'm tired of it because the problem is it used to be like the sign that someone cared and made good coffee, and I've had the worst coffee with the fanciest design. So I think I'm kind of over it.
Well, that does get to a follow-up question is, does it matter what the coffee looks like or tastes like, right?
You know, people have asked within the industry, why isn't there a TV show about coffee? And part of the reason why there isn't a TV show about coffee, but there is, like, cake decorating and stuff, is cake decorating is inherently visual, whereas coffee just looks like all brown water or some version of that. And so I think that people try to add a little bit of a flourish to make it appealing visually, because people like to say you eat with your eyes. But it doesn't mean it's going to taste good. Just like a cake can be beautiful.
Be the one thing you know about that is that the milk has been steamed in a way sweet. It doesn't mean the coffee's any better. It means they know how to do the milk right, is actually what it means.
And I think now that everybody's doing rosettas and hearts and monkey butt faces and whatnot.
Butt face.
I think it's important that baristas are making beautiful drinks that also taste incredible and are highlighting the coffee.
But I know there's a coffee house someone was telling me about, and I haven't seen it, but they've invented a new brewing method, and I couldn't even follow the whole thing. And it was a jug, and you heat it, and you put the coffee, and you mix it with the water, then you put it in hot coals. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what it was, but it made no sense. And he said, well, why are you doing this? And he goes, because it looks really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh,
gosh.
So I think you can have the appearance versus taste get a little out of skew. Mm-hmm.
All right, let's move on. Should coffee be stored in the freezer?
Oh, that's a great question. You want to take it?
No.
Generally speaking, you know, you'll get varying responses on this. I think that the one that we've tested and I feel good about it is that if it goes in the freezer, you can put it in the freezer. But once it goes in and out once, that's it. It can't go back in again because the water that will condense and then freeze again, and it's really will degrade the coffee quality even faster than not putting it. So buy a bag of coffee, split it up into small baggies, throw them in the back sort of recesses of your freezer, and then grab them one at a time and do it that way.
But that's only if you, let's say you buy a pound of coffee at your favorite roastery, and then all of a sudden you have to leave town for a week. What do you do? It's like the last resort, because really...
It's for an emergency situation.
It's an emergency. Because the best situation is just buy it like you would buy a loaf of French bread. You have a week to use the fresh coffee. You keep it in an airtight container in a room temperature, just like your pantry temperature setting in an airtight container, and you're fine.
I think people do it because it's supposedly temperature and humidity stable. And I mean, frankly, if you want to kill a pound of coffee, just send it to Phoenix in the summer. I mean, coffee dies in these sort of climates or these really humid climates. So maybe it's a good option one place. I don't think Bay Area is great for coffee. So
yeah.
Mostly.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on.
But never with the refrigerator.
Okay, you hear that, listeners.
Never with kimchi in that next year.
All right, two words here. Coffee pods.
Two words. One is a coffee and the other is a pod.
What are coffee pods?
It doesn't come... coffee comes from a fruit. People think it's a bean, but it doesn't come from a pod.
It's a shrub.
Is that what they're... No, okay, they're talking about the prepackaged capsule coffee.
Capsule coffee. The most popular one being the Keurig K-Cups from Green Mountain Coffee. Simply put, when you have pre-ground coffee that way, it's like having your vegetables chopped ahead of time for you for whatever you're cooking. It's just really not going to turn out that great. And they'll do all these things like nitrogen flush it and whatever, but it's not really going to give you the best flavor as possible. And there's a lot of trash that comes with those at the end.
It is such a great marketing scam, though. I mean, it's so expensive. You have to buy this machine, and then you buy all these single packets.
Well, it's the Hungry Man dinner for coffee. Yeah.
Well, the equivalent per pound is $35 or so.
More than that sometimes.
Per pound.
Yeah.
So there's a huge profit margin. And and Nespresso, to be fair, since I travel and I see how they work and what they buy and their quality, Nespresso, in some cases, is buying some amazing quality coffees. I wouldn't vouch for any of the others. And yet, you know, the coffee's not going to be that fresh.
Yeah, it's pre-ground.
How many times can I microwave my coffee? Because I'm going to do it.
36, actually.
I would think 37, which is really... What do you mean microwave? Oh, over and over again? There is, you know, people talk about the antioxidant properties of coffee. The main antioxidant is called chlorogenic acid. When you heat it and reheat it and keep it hot, that breaks down into what's called quinic acid and caffeic acid, which are very bitter and yucky. Don't do it. It's yucky.
And that's what you get when you see a glass carafe at your diner that's been sitting on that heated heat pad.
And Flo gets it for you.
It gets brackish. Yeah. It gets brackish and salty and... And that's a breakdown of acids as well as just oxidizing. So a microwave.
I microwaved coffee just like on Sunday. So
how did it taste?
It's fine. You know, I wanted it a little warmer.
But one time or 36 times?
36. I ate White Castle microwave burgers last week too, so it's okay.
Okay.
Is charcoal a good or bad coffee word?
Charcoal?
Charcoal?
As a descriptor.
That's a bad roasting description. That means it's like carbonized because the coffee bean is mainly cellulose, which is wood. So you char the wood. Yeah, charcoal, not good.
Okay, we have time for one more before we start to wrap it up. What's a peaberry?
Oh.
A peaberry, it's a failure of the coffee tree to produce two half beans, which would have a flat side and would face each other inside the cherry.
You think it's a failure?
It's aborted, the one...
Ow, man!
It's a natural mutation. I guess some say it's about 10% of the crop.
It depends. And I mean, it really is from, you know, poor nutrition and other problems. So you don't want to see a lot of peaberry or from poor management of the tree. But it is, the one seed has then filled out the total rounded form. And you'll have its little aborted brother or sister is this little shell on the side, which just gets thrown away. Yeah. So it's kind of a sad story.
So dramatic.
Okay, we just really quickly, could you each just tell us in a sentence or so what you're up to next? I understand you guys are going to be opening a cafe. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, we have our coffee right now at Cafe 3016 over in East Oakland. But around 1st of November, we'll be announcing that we're going to be opening a cafe in conjunction with some nice folks.
And Tom, what's in store for you?
God, I just drew a total blank. I don't know. I just think about my next trip, which will be Ethiopia, and I just got back from Brazil, which was crazy, but I guess that's it.
And Frida, you just opened a kind of second location, right?
We did. So I think I'm just going to nurse the baby that's 1 year old at Flowerland, our coffee trailer, and we'll see what happens next.
All right. Well, thank you all very, very much for joining us on City Visions this evening. This has been great.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Tom Owen, Trish Rothgeb, Nick Cho, and Frida Hoffman. Thanks to all of you for joining us. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Thanks for listening to KLW, your local public radio station. Good night and have a great week.